This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Children in out-of-home care are kids who've been removed from their parents or primary caregivers and placed by the state with friends or relatives in group homes, residential treatment facilities, or foster care families. Right now in Florida, there are more than 24,000 children in out-of-home care, and that's nearly 7,000 more kids than 5 years ago. The sharp rise is mostly being driven by increased rates of substance abuse and the opioid epidemic. There was a great feature story about this issue recently in Florida Weekly by one of their staff writers, Evan Williams. And we brought Evan in today to debrief us on his story and to hear from some of the voices in it. So welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Evan, it's great to have you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
We're also joined today by Nadra Salim, the CEO of the Children's Network of Southwest Florida. Nadra, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We've also got Patrice Cunningham. She's the Senior Special Projects Manager with the Family Mentor Program at the United Way of Lee, Hendry, Glades, and Okeechobee Counties. Patrice, thank you so much for your time.
Glad to be here as well.
We're also joined by Kara Jansen. She's a foster and adoptive mom. Kara, thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And last but not least, we're joined on the phone by Kurt Kelly. He's the CEO of the Florida Coalition of Children. Kurt, we appreciate your time today as well.
It's great to be here.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. Our 877 number is not working today, so the number to call in is 239-590-2580. I'm going to give you that again because it's different from our usual number. It's 239-590-2580. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So, Evan, I want to start with you because it's your story that kind of brought our attention to this. How did this story come to your attention?
Through my editor, Betty Wells, we talked about it. We were wondering, as we were talking about before the show, if the opioid epidemic had caused an increase in kids coming into the system. And that's what got us started on the story. And we found that, as you can see in the story, we think it did, even though when they do an investigation or a removal, from what I understand, it's not specified what type of drug the parents or caregivers were using, but pretty much everyone we talked to believed that the opioid epidemic was having a big effect on kids coming into the system.
Your editor, I had her on the show here a while back. She's super bright. We've been talking also in our newsroom. We're like, okay, that we hear about this opioid epidemic. There's so many overdoses. There are so many parents that are addicted, that are having difficulties, and they can't overcome this. A lot of these people have kids, so it stands to reason, but it hasn't really been quantified data-wise by the state or anything as far as how the opioid epidemic has impacted that?
Not that I know of. Not quantified with numbers.
Yeah.
No. Basically just anecdotally.
Yeah, but the numbers, were you surprised by what you found?
Yeah. I was surprised by just over the last 5 years overall the number of kids in the system, which I was told by the state that that's due to new kids coming to the system, but also kids staying longer in the system than before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot. I was just thousands and thousands of kids. I guess I would have expected some increase, but not that much over time, I guess.
It's interesting. I wonder how much it goes hand in hand with. We've also talked with teen homelessness, and I know that they have. Even in Collier County, they have somebody with a school district that is working on getting teenagers to school to try to help them out and help facilitate that because they're couch surfing because their family situation has deteriorated. So, I mean, they're not quantified in your story necessarily because they're not part of that data set. But
absolutely.
It's
yeah.
probably even greater than maybe even the numbers that you got.
I think there are a lot of reasons why kids come into foster care. I mean, the drug abuse is, I think, from what I understand, historically has always been one of the biggest reasons. But there's certainly a lot of other reasons it's coming to the system as well.
I'm going to turn now to Kurt Kelly. Tell me a little bit about the Florida Coalition of Children.
Well, probably the best way to say is Florida Coalition for Children, but because we are quite the advocates as an organization. I represent all of the community-based care organizations in Florida, including. Many of our providers that provide services for children.
Hey, Kurt, you're kind of sounding like a robot offline. We got a bad connection there. So we're going to call you back and because I want people to be able to understand what you're saying. So I'm going to turn now instead to in studio. Nadra Salim, tell me a little bit about Southwest Florida and the Children's Network of Southwest Florida.
Sure. So Children's Network is the community-based care lead agency. We're a not-for-profit organization that serves the five counties of Southwest Florida. And our primary responsibility is ensuring safe safety of children that have been either abused, neglected, or abandoned, or are at risk of abuse or neglect. And our primary responsibility is safety of the children and preservation of the family that we do through providing services, supervision of the family, and getting children to permanency.
Before we went on the air, you said that, for example, there was a bust that happened locally. What happened there? Is this what you come in to look at work in the morning and get a report of criminal investigations or things that have happened that could have impacted kids? You get this
yes.
on your desk when you get in on Monday.
Every morning, 7 days a week, we begin our day by looking at the probable cause statements, which is when children are removed from their parents due to whatever reason, you know, there's legal action, court action, and we read that to see exactly what happened. So, for instance, today there was a drug bust in one of our communities, and as a result, you know, 7-8 kids were removed from multiple families. This is typical for us.
Typical, like on a monthly way or
on a
weekly?
Daily.
Daily.
Daily. Whether it's children being born to addicted moms, kids are born addicted, or, you know, in our NICUs, in our hospitals, or kids are left without supervision, you know, kids are getting hurt. It's a sad situation.
What leads to a kid being taken from their parents' house? Is it that easy to do?
Well, what happens is the Department of Children and Families protective investigators are responsible for assessing a situation that they walk in to see whether children can remain safely at home or can remain with some safeguards put in place. So that's what causes kids to be removed. If they cannot ensure the children's safety, then they're forced to remove them from, you know, dangerous and unhealthy situations. And then the job of, okay, so now what do we do begins. You know, we need to find families, preferably relatives and friends of the family, or, you know, if not, foster parents to ensure that they have a home to be at. And, you know, we start working with the family to put them back together safely.
Is there any home in which a parent or caregiver is dealing with an addiction that is safe for a kid to be in?
Well, you know, we can create safety plans even in homes that are struggling from substance abuse, mental health, or DV. We look at the, you know, the protective factors of the parent as well as the support that's around them. It could be that they have neighbors and relatives and other family members or, you know, church community that can come in daily and ensure that the parent stays on the right track to not harm their children. So, yes, we can ensure safety with the proper services. Not in every situation, but to the extent that we can, you know, we will.
I mean, I just kind of wonder because I'm thinking about maybe parents that do have an addiction problem maybe being afraid to seek help because they don't want to lose their children as a result of admitting that there's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a risk for parents or can you allay any of those fears?
Yeah, well, we can. I mean, you know, there's community support groups that the parents can participate in. We have safety managers that can go into the home multiple times a day if necessary at times where we know that the stress on the parent is high and the possibility of using or relapse is high. So there are many ways that we can, you know, assess each family on its own merit and its own problems and support and determine whether kids can remain home safely.
Yeah. I imagine there's a lot out there, but I think there's probably a lot of fear, too. People may not want to be identified and they don't want to lose their kids, but they do want to do what's best for them.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And it's interesting to get them. From what I've heard, the state doesn't necessarily want to take kids out of parents' homes.
They don't. The state wants to keep families together, but they also have to make sure the kids are safe. So, yes, every effort is being made to keep families together with services if that's possible.
So I'm going to go back to Kurt. Kurt, you're on the phone with us again?
Better.
You're there?
Yes.
All right. You sound great now. just don't turn your head while you're talking. So we were talking about the Florida Coalition for Children. Tell me a little bit about the need for foster care families in recent years and how that has changed.
Well, you know, Florida's system of care that is set up by the legislature, it's a unique system of care. It gets communities deeply involved with this issue of going out and recruiting and developing foster families. We've gone from one of the worst systems of care back in the mid-90s to one of the best systems of care in the United States today. So we've made some great progress. However, whenever the system has something that begins to put a strain on it, like the opioid epidemic that has hit our state in a major way, let me just give you an example. An area like Sarasota,
had, over the last 2 years, had almost a 200% increase of kids coming into care. And they can actually make that almost directly associated with the opioid epidemic that has hit us. You see the same thing in Broward, and of course Southwest Florida has taken much more of its share than maybe some other areas of the state. However, even just the last year or so, we're starting to see areas in the panhandle, like Pensacola and particularly Panama City, where the opioid epidemic is really now beginning to strain the system. Now, here's why. When a child, there may be a report that someone's called in and says there may be some abuse, there may be some neglect, and the Department of Children and Families will come in and they will do an evaluation to see if that's truly the case and whether it reaches to the level where that child should be removed for the safety and security of that child and the well-being of that child. And that's what we normally work with. But when you get into the opioid issues, many of the times the call is coming into us because the parent has overdosed, and in many cases, they've died. So the children are now become orphaned. And when that happens, they're not taking one child out, or maybe two children out of the home. They're taking the entire family. They're taking all of the children. And so as Nataray mentioned this morning, we'll have 7 and 8 kids come into the system automatically. And the way Florida's set up is we have a no eject, no reject. In other words, we will immediately have to take those kids into the system and to find the right place to place these children, depending on what the circumstances are immediately. So it is a challenge, and we have seen the growth over the last 3 years at an extraordinary level.
Is there any way to quantify or to put some numbers to the number of kids that are in the foster system that you mentioned earlier? Like, for example, in Sarasota, it went up 200%. Is that, of that 200% increase, can you guesstimate how many are increased because of a parent dying, overdosing and dying, or just being taken out because of the drug abuse problem and the parents are still there? Like, how many do you think are actually orphaned?
Yeah, I don't want to venture a guess because that would be strictly a guess on my part. But I would tell you that if we sat down with our lead agencies and began to try to quantify those numbers, they would come back. We could probably come up with a number that would address that. I know the department does this, the same thing. They could work with us, and we probably should do this. Let me just give you a quick little history. I was a former state representative. And when I was in the legislature, I actually was the representative that finally got the prescription drug bill passed. This is the one where we had all the pill mills, and it was a major issue. We had about 10 of our citizens a day that were dying from overdose from these pill mills, that the opioids that were coming this way. We dealt with that issue properly. But unfortunately, we didn't deal with the drug issue, the total drug issue. And quite frankly, today, the opioid issue, with it tying in with fentanyl and so forth and the hot shots, it's actually much more deadly. And so it's a real issue. I don't have a number to actually tell you that. Maybe we should get that number. But we do know this, that over when the opioid issue began to be front and center in a lot of people's minds and seeing it, it was quite clear that this was one of the major drivers. It's not the only driver to what's happening. Florida's growing. Florida has a major growth in our population, and so you can look at percentages, and that's one thing, but we look at individuals. We look at children that come into care, and our population has grown because Florida is growing. We have more folks coming in. Our poverty level is still higher than the normal average or the national average. And so these are all driving factors that will affect the fact that we have to take care of children that need our support and help when it's time to come into care.
Well, as far as accumulating that data, I'm sure that so far we've been trying to react to the needs that are happening, you know, day to day, as opposed to trying to quantify everything. So I kind of understand where you're coming from. But that would be an interesting number to find out exactly how many kids are being orphaned as a result of this opioid epidemic. If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking to a panel of guests about the strain that's being put on the child welfare system in Florida by a spike in the number of kids who need foster homes. We've got a panel of guests with us today, Evan Williams from Florida Weekly, Nadra Salim from the Children's Network of Southwest Florida, Patrice Cunningham with the United Way of Lee Hendry Glades and Okeechobee Counties, also Kara Jansen, who is a foster and adoptive mom, and Kurt Kelly from the Florida Coalition of Children. Have you ever been a foster parent, or maybe you've considered becoming one? If you've got a question or comment and you'd like to add to our conversation, give us a call now, 239-590-2580. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. Patrice Cunningham, I want to turn to you now. You've been really patient with us. Tell me about the Family Mentor Program. What is that?
Well, it's a program the Children's Network came to the United Way about 3 years ago, and what they saw was a gap in support for parents. So as parents are being reunited with their children after being in the system, what we wanted to do was prevent those kids from coming back into the system. And what we saw was support for the kids. We had guardian ad litem, some other programs, but we didn't have anything for the parents.
That's the tough job.
That is the tough job.
Especially if you're trying to take care of yourself after you've overcome an addiction and then kids are stressful. I've got one.
Yes, I do too. And they're stressful in the best of situations.
Yes.
So take a, young single mom. A lot of the folks we work with are, mostly female, young moms, for example. So what we did was we started recruiting mentors to work with those parents right at reunification. So the kids, the parents have done all the right things. They've done the classes. They're getting their kids back. But now they haven't seen them for a year and they haven't been living at home. And what we want to do is avoid all those stresses that got them in whatever situation in the first place. So our mentors are – a lot of what they work on is budgeting, because we know that if you don't have enough money, you're not feeding them. The neglect comes in that way.
Oh, and economic stress also.
Yes.
That's one of the worst.
And that's all of us. So we work on all of those things, and we have mentors who are – again, we've worked with getting them GEDs, how to communicate with their bosses, how to apply for a job, keep a job, communication, a lot of things that way.
And I'm sure they've gone through a lot of emotional counseling as somebody who's in the process of recovering from addiction too.
Correct.
So there's going to be that they may end up having a – do you sometimes find that you have parents that end up having a better relationship with their kids than they did in the first place?
Yes. And this what they're doing is they've got someone – with a mentor, they have someone to lean on. Again, like we talked about Florida, a lot of folks come here. They don't have family to lean on. They don't have – they may not have had the parenting that some – these great parents that some –
well, they don't have their grandparents right down the road.
Right.
So,
I rely on my mother all the time to help with my kids, So these are just – the mentors are there for support. They're a listening ear. It's someone to encourage them, say, this is part of life. We'll get over this. We'll move forward. It's just day-to-day activities that stress all of us out. They've got, a friend – to lean on.
Do you ever do any training of foster parents to be? Is that part of your scope? No?
No.
Okay.
But we have a lot of the same training. We talk about safety. We talk about, parenting skills, safety, ethics, things like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Nadra, tell me, what do you do to train a foster parent? Do you guys work on that?
Yes, we do actually. So,
what does it take to be a foster parent? Besides a giant heart.
Well, that's a big one. Giant heart and the willingness and the commitment to say, I'm going to stick by this child or children until they're ready to go home and find their permanency. So what we do is we have open houses for the community. We run them a couple of times a week. People can come in and get information about what's it like to be a foster parent, what will it take. And then we put them through a 5-week training, which is just one night a week for 3 hours. And then they have to do 5 sessions online themselves. It's a total of about 30 hours spread across, probably 2-3 months. During that time, we are vetting the family out. We do level 2 background checks. We do reference checks. We go to the home, inspect the home, make sure they have adequate space and that the environment is safe and hazard-free. And so we assess the family, and together we decide, how many children they would be able to foster, what is the appropriate age, what are some of the behaviors or challenges of kids that they can handle. And then we, ask the department to submit a license, issue a license for the foster families, and then they begin taking care of our kids.
How often do you end up in a foster situation that becomes an adoption?
A lot. Actually, probably a good 60% or so of the kids that get adopted by the foster families. because the family's already bonded, attached, they've already taken care of the child typically for a year or so. And so, you know, you talk about the bonding and, you know, what's best for that child. Well, it's best to be adopted by the family that's cared for them. And if that's not possible, then we recruit for other, you know, prospective adoptive families.
And one of the things in Evan's story that I thought was really interesting is that the length of time that kids are staying with foster families has become extended. What do you owe that to?
Well, I mean, by law, biological parents are given 12 months typically to overcome whatever brought them to our attention.
So they basically have a year to get it together.
Yes, that's right. By federal law. And so sometimes parents need a little bit longer. You know, maybe there's issues, you know, barriers. There's transportation and different things that get in the way. Sometimes there's relapse. It could be many things. But typically 12 to, you know, 14, 16 months is about how much time we spend with a family before we say, okay, it's time to move on. And whether move on means you're successfully reunited with your child or we go to guardianship, the child is with a relative, or we go to adoption and find a forever family for the kids.
And that's because that's what the law is, really?
That's because that's what the law is.
Do you ever have foster parents that have a really hard time letting the kids go back?
We do. But, you know, that's something we talk about right out of the gate. We say you have to have the ability to love them like they're your own children, but be able to let them go. You know, of course, let them go to another safe environment. So, yeah, some folks have a hard time. And then we together decide, well, maybe fostering is not for you. Maybe you really only need to adopt, or you really only need to be a mentor to an adult. So, yes, we definitely assess that and help the families overcome that.
Do you have enough foster families right now?
No.
Do you have like a Rolodex of foster families that you call on when you have certain kids?
We do.
I'm old school with the Rolodex. But do you have like a file of here of people that are interested in fostering and maybe they would be a great match, but you just don't have enough of those to go to at this point?
Yeah. So
How many do you need?
Right now we have 342 foster homes in our five counties and have a bed capacity of 696 beds. I really could certainly use a couple of more hundred more foster families, because what that will allow me to do is be able to make a good match. You know, not every – it's not like one for one. It's not a child and a bed. It's a child and a family that has the strength to take care of that child's needs. So, you know, it's sort of like if I had more homes, I could really make a better match of placing kids in homes that are able to take care of them, whether it's with, you know, a certain age group or sex or special needs, behavior challenges and things of that nature.
It's a pretty complex process. But during that process where you're trying to find the right family for the right kid and things like that, where are they in that period?
The children?
Yeah.
Well, typically they're either in foster homes. We have a couple of shelter facilities that the kids stay at until
Like a group home?
Like a group home, yes. And, you know, we have to do assessments of the child and, you know, make a match. And so it is a process. However, a lot of times the kids go straight into a foster home. Mm-hmm. What we're hoping for is that the first placement is the last placement and that kids don't bounce around.
Yeah, that bouncing around has to take a toll. What kind of group home do we have going on in our area now? Do we have like a couple of them? How many beds are in group? How many kids are in beds in group homes in our area right now?
So we have about 111 kids that are in group settings. And that could be residential treatment where the kids are there for a special treatment, whether it's mental health or substance abuse. And then we have just regular group homes that we use for sibling groups, because a lot of our foster homes cannot – you know, take five or six siblings. And then we have just a regular shelter facility where kids go and stay hopefully for 30 days or less until we assess them to make a good proper match. And we have, you know, six facilities in our five counties that are group facilities and group settings.
So, Kara, I'm going to turn to you now. Tell me your story. You're a foster mom and you've adopted a child.
Yes. I was a foster mom when I was single and lived in Alabama. And then I have been a foster parent here in Florida for about a little over 4 years. We now have six kids in our home. Five of those are adopted, and one is still a foster child.
Sounds like you kind of fall for them pretty easy. You're a soft touch, aren't you?
The kids. I love them.
So tell me about the kids. I mean, without giving all the details because right. They're underage, but tell me a little bit about the different kids and how they have been emotionally and how they've changed over time.
Now, we have had kids from as young as just released from the hospital all the way to, I think our oldest was maybe 13. And depends on their background, depends on what brought them into care. But for the most part, these kids just need to be loved. They need to be wanted. And they need to know that somebody's there that has their back. And, you know, they're typical kids, but they have – some of them have more challenges than others based on what they've been exposed to.
What kind of challenges have you dealt with then?
We've had – well, most of it's behavior. You know, a child who has gone hungry, for example, will hoard food. A child who has been beaten will shy away if you even raise your voice at them. I had a child come in my home, and she wouldn't sit down on my furniture until I gave her permission. And that probably broke my heart more than anything else, because she just kind of stood around. I'm like, do you want to sit down? And she nodded her head yes. And, you know, I said, you're welcome to do whatever, you know, anybody, any of the other kids in the house do.
How long did it take her to come around? Because those learned behaviors are hard to unlearn.
She came around pretty quickly, but she still had some hesitation. She was always a little more on the cautious side. She wasn't with us very long. She was reunited with her father.
Are you able to keep up with her after she goes back to her dad?
I actually have kept up with her. I've kept up with several of our kids that have gone home. I try to build a relationship with the parents.
So you're kind of doing part of the parent mentor thing, sort of.
And so when a foster parent builds that bridge with the biological parents, that really strengthens everything, because then we become extended family. Even some of the kids that we've adopted, we still reach out to their biological family. We still do things with their biological family. We don't cut them off on our end when they're adopted, as long as it's healthy for the children to continue.
Have you ever had a situation in which you've had a kid that was with you for a while and the parents were okay for them to go back and then it didn't work out with the parent?
We have.
Did the kids then come back to you, or did they go somewhere else? Because she knows you.
Yes. She had been with us for quite some time, about a year and a half, and was reunited. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. And a few months later, she came back into the system. The phone call I got was, nobody wants to put this child with anybody but you. And I said, you better not put that child with anybody but
me. Yeah, wouldn't you hope you'd be the first phone call?
I was. Good. And they usually try to do that. They try to put the children with people that they know, that it's less traumatic for the children.
It's a big system. It's called a system for a reason.
Right.
So it's kind of, it makes you a little scared that something could get lost, or someone might get lost, you know?
But I don't think – for the most part, they're not. They keep good records of where the children have been before, and I believe they do make an effort to reach out to those families. And as long as there's room for that child in the home, they do go back. This particular child ended up becoming ours, but she's one that we still connect with her family. You know, it was a generational thing for her. And
tell me about Adoption Day. I know we're kind of jumping ahead. I know we're talking about we need foster kids. But it's just so – it's got to be just really heartening when that day happens and it suddenly becomes real for that kid that they're not going anywhere.
It's a bittersweet day because you know that family's never going back together. But on the other hand, yes, it's a blessing to know that child never has to worry about where her home is. Home is permanent now. So it's a beautiful day, and you know, different kids, different ages of kids will have different reactions. The older the child, the more input they have on whether or not they're adopted, obviously. The younger the child, they don't have a lot of input. But one thing I do recognize is when a child is old enough that they are considered, their wishes are considered on whether they want to be adopted by that family or not.
Tell me a little bit about the experience that you've had with kids that have gone to numerous places versus to only a couple or just one, you know?
Right. The kids that we've had that have had multiple placements prior to us have a harder time trusting that they're there till they stay. We had one, she was probably 10 or 11 at the time, and we were her fifth placement in a very short period of time. And I remember we were, you know, she had come with her things in a garbage bag and I was getting rid of the garbage bag. She goes, well, when I go to my next placement, you're just going to have to give me a new garbage bag. And I said, no, you're not going anywhere until the judge tells you you're going somewhere else, you know, until the judge says you can go home or whatever the permanent thing is. And it was like she looked at me like, that's real, you know, and the relief. And she still tested me from time to time. To make sure that I was true with that. She would try, you know, different behaviors. But once she started to realize that, you know, just her behaviors alone of, you know, yelling at me or fussing or refusing to do what I've asked her to do, those are not going to get her, you know, I'm not going to let her go. Then she started to relax and to trust.
And maybe not test you as much.
And not test me as much. She still continued to test until she was reunified with the father. But yeah, she continued to.
So the current situation at your home, you have six kids, you said?
I have six kids in my home.
Wow. What ages, you say? 13 to four?
I have a 14-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 4-year-old. A 2-year-old and a 1-year-old.
Do these guys kind of have a camaraderie because of the shared experience that they've had? I mean, I know the little ones are kind of young, but I mean, not a lot of first and kindergartners have gone through what they've gone through.
Right. And they do. I mean, most of them have been with us. The ones that are there now have been with us since they were little. Mm-hmm. So they all of the ones that we currently have come to us as babies. So they don't remember a whole lot of life outside except for the one who was reunified and then came back. But yeah, they treat each other like brothers and sisters as if they were born into the same family. They fight and they help each other and support each other just like, you know, any siblings do.
Yeah.
So,
Nadira, we talked earlier and you said something about that you want the first placement to be the last placement, that you don't want them bouncing around. What is the risk of a child going from one place to another to another?
Well, it just depends on the level of trauma that they've experienced. You know, a lot of what we see in kids is just the trauma of whether it's abuse, neglect, whatever it is, manifests itself in anger and, you know, lying, running away, you know, destruction of property, cursing, all those things that Kara kind of pointed to that causes them to disrupt the placement. So what we need is for the adults to understand that if a child is yelling at you profanities or whatever they're doing, it's really their trauma. They have no other way of expressing themselves. So it just depends. If that's the first abuse on that child and so level of trauma is not as severe, then likelihood that a family could, you know, deal with the experiences that the kids had and the, you know, whatever behavior it manifests itself in. But the kids that have been traumatized multiple times or egregious abuse or chronic trauma then obviously require the kinds of foster parents that have, you know, the skills, the training and the compassion and the stick-to-itness to look past that and say, I know what this is. This isn't directed at me. This is trauma just screaming out for help.
Hard to deal with, especially if you have other kids in the house, you know, and you
Absolutely.
Don't want them hearing all that because then they could become traumatized by the kids' behavior, you know, and
Indeed.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, Evan, in your story, you talked a little bit about the nexus between kids in need who wind up on the streets. I mean, we're talking about kids who eventually Yeah. become teenagers, and they want to have that self-sufficiency because they don't want to have to depend on anybody, a system, a family that they may not recognize as their own family. So that can be appealing to some of these kids when they become old enough.
Yes.
Or even before they become old. Well, nobody's old enough. Okay,
well,
but let me correct that statement.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Very young. The instability in the system, kids that do bounce around a lot and have had some really tough experiences, I think that does make them more likely to fall prey to human traffickers. And that was one of the things we covered in this story. I talked to a young woman from Tampa who is – she just aged out of the system. And she sounds like she's doing pretty well now.
In cosmetology school now?
Cosmetology school. Mm-hmm. And her name is Portia. And she's with Florida Youth Shine. It's a advocacy group made up of foster kids and former foster kids. And she said when she was 13, she started being trafficked at her own. She was – it was by her own choice. And she was happy to make the money. And that – at the time, and it gave her some sense of control when she felt like there wasn't any other control in her life. So, yeah, I think that's a big problem for foster kids. And from what I understand, human traffickers target them because of their trauma and their insecurities. Maybe they don't feel loved and they find some type of feeling of being wanted and making money.
Sort of a mechanism of independence too plays
yeah.
in there, right? Did it surprise you that you uncovered that part of the story?
No, I did a few months ago. Can't remember how long ago. We did a story about human trafficking and this came up. So I knew it was an issue already. And the people I spoke with just confirmed that for this story as well.
With kids that are insecure, I mean, that's always an easy target for yeah. these guys, these predators.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask Patrice a little bit, being from the United Way of Lee, Hendry, Glades, and Okeechobee counties, you have a pretty wide swath of territory. Is
yes.
there any difference? Do you see any difference between coastal communities and the inland communities as far as numbers and prevalence of kids that are in the foster system?
Well, we see because of just the sheer population and the way the communities are, we have more foster kids in Lee County. The numbers are quite different out in Lee and Hendry. I think they have a little more family stability, and Notary can probably back me up on that. But we are seeing like Charlotte County, because we help recruit for Charlotte County as well for mentors. So Charlotte County and Lee County are a lot higher mm-hmm. than Hendry Glades or Okeechobee.
That could just be a function population. Of the population mm-hmm. size and density.
Pretty much.
So tell me a little bit, Nadira, about the kids that you have now. Is there a demographic tendency? Do you have middle income, higher income, lower income? Is there a difference? I mean, and has the opioid epidemic changed that?
So for the most part, you know, poverty is one of the factors, is one of the drivers of kids coming to us, definitely. You know, the four main areas that drive child abuse: substance abuse, mental health, domestic violence, and then poverty. And when you mix those together, because typically we don't come across a family that just presents itself with one issue, typically you see, you know, some combination of those. You know, now we have about out of our 2,500 kids, a little over 1,200 are children under 5 years of age. And that, again, goes to the issue of substance abuse and the exposure of these kids and families to opioid. A lot of kids are being taken at a younger age because their, you know, inability to self-protect. They're typically not seen in the community, are not verbal. And so, you know, that didn't used to be the case. You know, the population, the shift to much younger children, you know, and I would tell you probably, I mean, I can tell you exactly about 672 children are under 2 years of age. So, again, these are young kids that are vulnerable, whose families are struggling, and they absolutely need our protection.
Previously, they were generally older, you were saying?
Well, they used to be kind of like 6 to 11 years of age. We didn't have, you know, a lot of infants. Now we have a lot of infants. So I can see the split is, you know, 0 to 5. And then it shifts to we have a little bit more kids that are 16 to 18 now, because those kids have their own challenges and are coming to us because the parents aren't able to deal with them anymore. So, you know, we're kind of straddling both ends of the age population.
Yes, That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That could make it more appealing. Do you find that foster parents would like to have younger kids instead of teenagers?
Well, I used to think that. Well, I mean, I would say yes. People are typically afraid of teenagers. I don't know exactly why, but
I kind of am. They scare me. They scare me too.
So, you know, but we used to have foster parents be able to take care of our infants, but now the need is so great. I mean, it's just the supply and demand. Yeah, absolutely. And the kids that are born with some kind of substance-exposed, you know, issues, they're not able to go into daycare. You know, the first, like, 12 weeks, you have to be home with the infant. So a lot of our foster parents work. So, you know, there's the limitation on child care until the infant is old enough to go into a daycare. So, you know, many factors are kind of playing into this. But if there's a family out there that would like to have an infant, by all means, just call us.
You're like, we have plenty. When a kid is born with addiction problems, do they get over it? Does it ever get out of their system to the point where they're functioning what we call, and I'm using air quotes, normal?
Mm-hmm. By grace of God, some yes and some no. Just depends on how exposed, you know, they have been. What is the degree of drug abuse? You know, if the mom is a chronic user, you know, heavy user, multiple drugs, you know, uses throughout the pregnancy, then obviously the challenges could be, you know, lifelong.
And Kurt Kelly, I'm going to turn back to you. Are you still there on the phone with us? Sorry, Kurt.
I am.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the Family First Prevention Services Act. What is that?
The Family First Prevention Services Act was just passed by the federal government. It's a bill that came out of Washington, D.C., with its intention to be able to move the system of care more to the prevention side of the equation versus where we have to live right now, and that is in where we have to deal with the issues. Since we've been talking about, by the way, I hope your listeners are hearing how complicated this process is. And often politicians and folks in the political world, and I know I'm a recovering politician, and so I do know that sometimes we wanted to do the right things. You want to do right things in policy, but you don't really have all of the experience and drill down and the expertise that is needed by people like Nataray and her professional staff that understand these issues at a granular level. So Washington passed a legislation that says, listen, let's try to get out front on this and do a lot of this prevention. We totally agree with that. We believe that that's an important area to go to. However, the way they're going to pay for it a lot of times is to stop some of the services and paying for some of the services that we need today, like some of the residential group homes. You heard about Nataray saying that there was a need for residential services and group homes. These group homes, especially in Southwest Florida, some really excellent group homes that have top-level professionals that know how to deal with all the trauma of these children that are coming into care. Many of these are our teenagers. They're 10, 11, 12, 13, all the way up to 18. And many of those children have been traumatized at a major level, several times in and out of the system, based upon what's going on with their family, more time in care. And so during that, these children really need a lot of real focused attention. The federal government says we believe every child deserves, this was their mantra, every child deserves a family. Well, we agree with that. We absolutely believe that. They had a family. It had problems, and that's why they've been removed. And many times in these residential homes, while we don't want them to be there forever, that's not the intention, they've changed the rules and the way that they look at these residential homes, and so they're going to make it more difficult to have residential group homes to provide these services, which then strains us by saying we need to go and find more foster families who can get more training and focus on these teenagers and the 13 and above or 12 and above. And we're going to need to be able to focus on them quite a bit more. There's a lot of training that's going to take place, a lot of trauma-informed knowledge that they're going to take when they bring these children into their homes and so forth. So it's a challenge, mm-hmm. But I think it's something that Florida is well-positioned to try to address. We are concerned about the dollars we're going to lose that could come to Florida, and I won't go into all the drill down on how that works. So we're working with our legislature to make sure that we don't let a well-intended bill have some very poor consequences for Floridian children that need our services.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there. So, Nedra, do you see this being a problem when it comes to funding for group homes, or is that something that we're going to work on the state level?
Well, it will be an issue for group homes. They have to convert themselves into treatment facilities. And again, you know, if we are conscious about the way we use our group homes and utilize them to actually provide a treatment, then I'm fully supportive of that. And there is a need for it, and we are utilizing it that way. Again, for sibling groups, large sibling groups, the only place you can really put them is in a group
large
facility.
Group home.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Or at her house. Before we run out of time, I wanted to ask real quick, how can people sign up to get involved in being a family mentor with the United Way?
Family mentor, they can just go to unitedwaylee.org/volunteer, and we're listed under there to become a mentor.
All right. And what kind of commitment on time are we looking at for someone that wants to do that?
We're looking at an hour a week. Most parents work with mentors work with parents from 3 to 6 months.
All right. And work with them for 3 to 6 months and then
mm-hmm.
get their kids back?
Yes.
Sounds great. And then I wanted to ask, if somebody's interested in becoming a foster parent, what do they need to do, Nedra?
They need to call 1-855-933-KIDS or go on our website, childnetswfl.org, or call our office, any number, and just say, I want to help. I want to be a foster or adoptive parent.
And if you missed any of that, you can always check the GulfCoastLive.org website, which has links on this show to the places that you can go if you wanted to help out or open your home, as the wonderful woman in my studio with us today just did. But we're about out of time for today's show, but I want to thank my guest, Evan Williams. He's a reporter from Florida Weekly. Evan, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you.
Great story. Nice reporting, by the way. Also, Nedra Salim, she is the CEO of the Children's Network of Southwest Florida. Nedra, thank you for talking with me.
My pleasure.
And Patrice Cunningham with the United Way of Lee Hendry Glades in Okeechobee Counties. Patrice, thanks for coming on in today. I appreciate it.
Anytime.
And Kara Jansen, she's a foster and adoptive mom. Kara, thanks to you as well for everything that you do.
Thank you.
I appreciate it, and the world appreciates it very much, and I'm sure your kids do too. Also, I want to thank Kurt Kelly, is the CEO of the Florida Coalition of Children. Kurt, thank you for spending the hour with us today.
And thank you for addressing this issue. We appreciate you.
Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.